I was out one evening and realized, you know, there's Wisconsin beer in every bar. There's Wisconsin wines in every restaurant. Why are there no Wisconsin spirits on the back shelf?
Greetings, and welcome to the Conversections podcast, the place where lessons for success lead to actionable insights. I'm your producer and host, Bill Mitchell. We can't succeed without an amazing underwriter. Our podcast is powered by WBD, your business finance resource, partnering with your local lender on affordable small business financing with longer terms, fixed rates, and less money down. Contact WBD or ask your lender about the SBA 504 loan program today. It's my pleasure to introduce our guest, Guy Rahorst, founder and CEO of Great Lakes Distillery and Tasting Room. Great Lakes is Wisconsin's original post-prohibition distillery, founded in 2004. It is known for its pioneering craft spirits and creating a welcoming community hub through its tasting room. Speaking of welcoming, welcome, Guy.
Thanks, Bill.
And thank you for hosting here at the distillery. You mentioned it doesn't open till noon, so I'm going to drag this out so I can sit at the bar afterwards. Our listeners like hearing origin stories, Guy. You launched Great Lakes Distillery in 2004. Wisconsin's first since Prohibition. What was the moment that made you say, I have to do this?
It was a development after a couple of years of experimentation. I was a home brewer, home winemaker. I did not like the home brew and the home wine I was making. I wasn't pleased with it. And out of curiosity, I wondered if I could distill some of this not so good beer. And I did, hoping it would turn out a little better. And it did. It improved it somewhat. I still couldn't get my friends to drink it, but that kind of led me on a path of discovery and did as much education of myself as I possibly could in distilling, and found a few opportunities to learn around the country to eventually get to a point where I was out one evening and realized, you know, there's Wisconsin beer in every bar. There's Wisconsin wines in every restaurant. Why are there no Wisconsin spirits on the back shelf? So I looked into the legal aspects of it a little further and discovered that I could probably open a distillery. There weren't a lot of them at that time. There were about 30 in the U.S. So it was very early on in the process, the development of craft distilling in general. There were none in Wisconsin. I called the Department of Revenue and I said, here's what I want to do. I want to open a distillery. Can you guys license me for that? And they said, well, sure, we can, but nobody in the department's ever done it before, so we're going to need some time to figure it out. So I got the federal license, called the state, and then they responded and took a couple months to get it worked out, but we got open.
Wow. So you were a pioneer with Department of Revenue.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Throughout our history, I've had to become very instrumental in getting various laws changed as well to enable us to do the business we do. So spent a lot of time in Madison.
And competitors are benefiting from that experience.
Oh, sure.
How about your background in broadcast engineering? How did that shape your approach to distilling and storytelling?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Number one, I'm an engineer first and a salesman probably number five down the list. So one of the things that did shape was that I knew the need of, you know, finding sales help. I know my own weaknesses and I'm not good at the sales end of it. So I think that had a lot to do with it. I could very easily build the distillery, understand how to build it, understand how to build the recipes, understand the process of distilling from a technical standpoint. But just for me, the biggest challenge is sales. Mm-hmm. And still is.
Still is. Yeah. You've been a trailblazer for handcrafted small batch production. Why is that important?
Well, I don't know if it is important. A trailblazer, I guess, in the respect that I always feel like if I hadn't done it, somebody else would have. We're up to almost 3,000 distilleries in the U.S. now, from about 30 craft distilleries when I started. And there is always somebody blazing a trail, and it's more navigating. You know, when we started, for example, I couldn't buy a few pallets of bottles. You know, our production was very small. Had to buy containers of bottles, and I had to get them from a company in France at the time. And their customer service was absolutely horrible. And I had to commit a lot of money to buying that inventory. Eventually what happened, and it happened more of as a volume thing, where it became easier to get bottles. We were able to start getting bottles in the U.S. directly. And as more distilleries came online, you know, more materials became easier to buy in small quantity.
Gotcha. For the benefit of our listeners, can you briefly describe the distilling process?
Sure. It's really like winemaking or beer making initially. You're fermenting your source of sugar.
For most distilled spirits, that's grain. And what you're doing is you're converting the starches in that grain into sugar and then feeding yeast to that sugar and feeding the sugar to the yeast. And the yeast is turning that sugar into alcohol. Once you get up to, in the case of grain, we get up to around 10% alcohol level in a very short amount of time, generally 3 days is all it takes.
And then we pump it into the still. The whole theory of distillation is that alcohol boils at a lower temperature than water. So as you start heating up the still, alcohol starts coming off first. Some of those alcohols are undesirable, so you need to, what they call, make cuts. You need to cut the heads of that, which is the beginning of the run, because it's less desirable and poisonous, frankly. Better distilling the good stuff, and you want to get as much of that out of that mash as you can. And then it goes into, depending on the product, goes into filtering. It can go directly into the bottle if it's a white spirit, like vodka or gin. If it is a brown spirit, it goes into a barrel and can sit there anywhere from a few months to many years.
And your team gets to make the decision which goes, or for how long it sits in the barrel?
We kind of have a plan when we do a new product. For example, we did a new bourbon.
We would ask ourselves, legally, do we want to make a straight bourbon? Do we want to make, which has got to be at least 2 years old? Do we want to make something younger? Which we generally don't. But the legal considerations to consider as well is, how's that bottle going to be labeled and packaged in the future? The product in a barrel, and you weigh. And you try it periodically, see what direction it's going with the flavor. Sometimes that means the product's good after 2 years. Other times that means, we're going to need probably 7 or 8 years on this.
Where do the barrels come from?
Kentucky. So we are getting our barrels. We have two cooperages that we buy from out of the Louisville, Kentucky area.
So they've been, obviously there's a huge leaf of them down there. So most of the producers are in the Louisville, central Kentucky area.
Mm-hmm. So managing your supply chain has got to be challenging. You mentioned bottles, barrels.
Yeah, there's a lot of components. In many cases, like I said, you can make a white spirit in about a week's time, but you're not going to get the labels that fast. So you got to plan ahead.
You're looking at anywhere from 4 weeks to 6 weeks, typically, to get labels printed. And in that process, we also have to get labels approved by the government, formulas approved by the government, before we can even begin to order the labels, because we need to know if they're going to approve them or not, what changes we might need to make.
So your engineering background must really come in handy in terms of managing all of those parts of the process at one time.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely a different mindset. There's people who are technically very good. There are people who are very creative. Yeah, I probably lean more toward the technical side, and I've been lucky in that I've done some experimentation with flavors and to know quite a bit about that as well, and can come out with usually a pretty darn good product.
Your spirits are deeply rooted in local ingredients and Midwestern agricultural heritage. Recently, I did a podcast interview with an artisanal baker in Madison, and he talked about the links to the farmers, the links to the whole agricultural industry in Wisconsin, which is kind of great history. Could you unpack your relationship with local ingredients and local sourcing a little bit more?
The whole point of our distillery is to use local ingredients whenever possible. Obviously, for things like an orange liqueur, we might have trouble finding local oranges, but we're still going to buy from a local provider. We, whenever possible, use everything local we can. We use Wisconsin cranberries. We use Wisconsin Door County cherries. We use ginseng from Marathon County. And our grains are grown near East Troy. And we try to source local as much as possible. It's just been our philosophy since day one. We want to support the people who are hopefully going to support us.
Your marketing communications infrastructure speaks to that as well. I assume website, emails, promotions.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's a great story to tell.
Yeah. You can't tell the same story all the time.
Right. So we break it up a bit, but that is an ongoing aspect of our marketing.
Right. Including social media, which I've learned through the podcast world is critical to have a presence there and be creative as you can be with.
Exactly.
There's over 7 million podcasts out there. So I'm in the soup with 7 million productions. You've created everything from Kinnickinnick whiskey to Rahorse gin. Is there a spirit that surprised you, either at how it turned out or how customers responded to it?
In 2007, the U.S. government re-legalized absinthe. Absinthe is a spirit that was very popular in Europe and the U.S. in the mid-1800s, early 1900s. It got a very bad rap, and the U.S. government, as well as some European governments, outlawed it in 1912. And basically, when we got wind a couple years in advance that the U.S. was likely going to re-legalize it, we decided to start working on a recipe. And we came up with a very authentic French-style absinthe, but also a little spin-off on a Spanish-style absinthe. So we initially came out with two. You know, we had no idea how interested people would be in it, but it has way surpassed my thoughts on how much people would enjoy it. And a lot of it is the lore of it. And initially when we started selling, there was a lot of misinformation. It's one of those spirits that you really got to educate people on. And we won some incredible awards for it. Double gold medal at San Francisco. We've been very fortunate. That was a fun one. It's not our biggest seller, but it sells consistently. Every month we're shipping out, and it's fun. And not a lot of people make it.
Is absinthe licorice?
It's anise.
Anise,
fennel, and grand wormwood are in it.
Really?
Yeah. And the reason it was originally outlawed was because there's a chemical in wormwood called thujone that the government was tricked into believing was a mind-altering substance. It is not. Never was. It took a chemist to prove that to the U.S. government back nearly 2000s.
Congratulations on another pioneering step.
Yeah, yes. That's a fun one.
How about talking about innovations, Guy? Do you decide which flavors, botanicals to explore next?
Yeah, myself and my production team do that. We basically will get an idea for a spirit. I'll give you an example, like our orange liqueur, which we came out with several years ago. It's delicious, and it's not just orange. There's a little ginger in there. There's cardamom. It's got a really unique taste that was through ideas and experimentation. I mean, we all, I think, are to some degree foodies and enjoy different flavors. And sometimes you will have an epiphany eating dinner and say, oh, this might make an interesting sphere.
Thanksgiving's on the horizon. Is there a product line item that would be a good fit for a Thanksgiving dinner?
Oh, definitely our cranberry liqueur.
Cranberry liqueur.
Yeah, Wisconsin cranberries. And everybody always has a little cranberry sauce on the table. Well, now you can get cranberry sauced.
Very nice. We'll put a link to that in the notes for the podcast. Sure. How do you balance tradition with experimentation? There's a lot of history in distilling. How do you balance that?
You try not to balance it, honestly. You will start out with tradition, and then we'll frequently do something a little different and a little odd. There's a lot of distilleries out there. We don't want to make the same thing that distilleries have been making forever. For example, our rum. Rum is made from sugarcane products, either sugar itself, cane sugar itself, or from sugarcane juice, cress juice. So it's kind of, everybody's kind of required to use the same ingredient. However, we wanted to put a little Wisconsin twist on ours. So we add maple syrup to it as well. And so we distill it with the maple syrup, kind of gives it a neat little different flavor from a traditional rum and makes it uniquely Wisconsin.
Hmm. So it's a team. It's you and production teams.
Three people in production, and we all start talking about our new product. We'll bounce it back and forth and see what we come up with.
Does the founder get two votes?
Well, there is that.
You have a reputation for a commitment to sustainability, Guy. What are some examples of you putting that into action with Great Lakes?
Yeah, well, part of that is, you know, again, using local ingredients. We're not trying to not ship ingredients from all over the country in. And, you know, Wisconsin is kind of unique in that there's a lot available to us. For example, grains. You can grow pretty much all the grains we need right in this state. The big guys down in Kentucky can't say that. They can't grow barley down there. It's a northern climate product. Rye is typically a northern climate product as well. So it's kind of neat from that aspect. We have a bottle reuse program that's kind of unique. And we did have to get permission from both the federal and the state government to do that, because basically they use, bottles are an audit source. You can tell how people are producing by how many bottles they're buying. We actually buy our bottles back from our customers, both commercially and consumers. Our commercial accounts, we get bottles from them and we pay them 50 cents a bottle. If a
consumer comes in with our bottles to the tasting room, we give them $1 in credit in the tasting room as well per bottle. It's kind of neat and unique. Nobody else is doing that in Wisconsin. I don't think there's very many people doing it in the U.S., period.
How about the byproducts of the distilling process? Does that have a use afterwards?
Yeah, a lot of times some of our spent grains will go to farmers. They'll use them for feed for various livestock or hogs. So.
The tagline for ConverSactions is Lessons for Success. Would you care to share one or two lessons that would benefit other entrepreneurs as they start their journey?
Sometimes I assume people know things, and then I talk to people and they don't. They say, what? It crossed my mind. The people that were getting into the business of distilling, I'll still get calls occasionally from people who are interested in getting into distilling, and they want to know if I can give them a device, and I do. And the first thing I always ask them is, if you're going to make a spirit, how are you going to sell it? Because frankly, it's not hard to make a good spirit, but selling is very difficult. And a lot of times people have no idea or plan, a sales plan. And the response I've often gotten is, oh, well, it's going to be so good, it'll sell itself. And nothing could be further from the truth, especially in the alcohol industry where you have, you know, three tiers. You have the distribution tier, the producer tier, the retailer, the seller. There's a lot of work to it. And a lot of times people don't think about all of it. One of the other things that I always think about and tell people is you need to plan for the ups and downs. Our first down was in 2008 when the economy kind of took a skid and people traded down in product. So we lost sales. We make a premium product. It's not cheap. We did lose some sales to cheaper brands at that time. But fortunately, we rode it out. The economy came back and people started drinking premium quality stuff again. Just being aware that things can change. We're in a changing environment right now. Beer, wine, and spirits. We're all kind of taking a beating right now in that people's drinking habits are changing. Because of that, you know, we need to figure out how to adjust our businesses to change with the customer.
With new product lines or?
That's right. And that's the question. In some regards, for example, canned cocktails have become huge. A lot of them are really bad. Quality-wise, and that's something we've been looking at and experimenting with, and we've figured out we can make a really good canned cocktail. The other problem, though, is we don't have a canning line. So now we've got to outsource the canning of product, and that in itself adds another expense. They tend to be lower margin products to begin with, just the nature of a canned cocktail. So, you know, we need to figure out how much are we going to produce and what are we going to produce? What kind of cocktail are we going to do? THC is another area, THC cocktails, which have no alcohol in them, but they do have, for example, Delta 9 THC, which is derived from hemp. And so a lot of people are switching from alcohol to those beverages as well. So a lot of ways to trip up and fall on your face if you don't make the right decision.
Right. So to that point, is there a market research component to your organization? How do you?
Yeah, myself, my marketer, our in-house marketing staff will look at these things. I'll talk to the distributors of our products and see, you know, what are you guys seeing in the market? What's selling? What's not? So there's definitely a good amount of time, you know, spent in research on those things.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. I appreciate the time. You did a great job, especially the success side of things. My listeners are interested in if I go down this path, entrepreneurial path or growth path, what should I watch out for? That's a very common theme, so I appreciate you sharing that with us. Our podcast is powered by WBD, your business finance resource, partnering with your local lender on affordable small business financing with longer terms, fixed rates, and less money down. Contact WBD or ask your lender about the SBA 504 loan program today. We'll see you next time.